The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
My next guest is an author and screenwriter, but believe it or not, at a time she even worked as a political advisor in the realms of Leinster House. She is involved in so many things at the moment, but her latest project, as far as I'm concerned, is her new book, which is called The Last to Disappear. Jo Spain, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much for having me on, Pat.
Let's talk about your book, first of all. I'm in the throes of it at the moment, and it features a guy who works in London normally, Alex is his name, and his sister Vicky disappears. And he goes to Lapland in to find out what happened to her because she turns up drowned. That's not a spoiler because that happens very early on. It's a brilliant novel. Absolutely.
Thank you. It's never a spoiler when we say that somebody's dead in one of my books. That's a given from the start. I've tried to send crime novels off where nobody dies because I don't like killing them. And my editor always comes back and says, Joe, that's we need a victim to begin with. I mean, this is the premise of this novel. She turns up dead in this frozen lake and her brother goes over and meets a young detective. She's a single mother.
Far too young for the job, he thinks.
That's his perception. And I've been asked before, is it an enjoyable thing as a writer to be able to kind of float over everybody and present everybody's different perceptions on life? And it is. It's like playing God, because no matter what I think of you when I'm the writer, everybody's got their own inner monologue. So you meet everybody in person. And we know when we meet Agatha, she's very efficient, she's very intelligent, and she's being promoted to that level because we can trust her. Alex has to learn to trust her. And
because he's used to, in London, the Metropolitan Police with all its resources. Agatha has very sparse resources in a very sparse countryside.
And it's all true. I mean, I picked that location and it's as much a character in the book as the characters. We are in pre-production on a show over there at the moment, so I've been in Lapland a few times. And it's always struck me, it's very beautiful, but very deadly. If you wander into a forest and there's a snowstorm, you will freeze to death. And the police over there cover jurisdictions that are far larger than anything we can imagine. And you tend to have maybe three cops in one station. You don't have the CCTV, you don't have the mobile phone triangulation. This is proper police work over vast areas. So you would, as a Londoner, be a bit suspicious that they could do anything.
Now, it's complicated because it's a high touristic area, particularly at Santa Claus time and all the rest of it. And people go for extreme winter sports and all of that. So normally, if you subtract the tourists, everyone would know everything that was going on in a sparsely populated place like Kope. Is that how you pronounce it?
Kope.
In Lapland. But then you add in the influx of tourists and things get a bit more complicated.
Yeah, and it's a small town. And like many of the small towns in Lapland, they're reliant on either tourism or mining. And they have to, for a few months of every year, kind of suck this up. And all of these incomers come in, and I guess in the small town they're thinking, you know, well, we'd no trouble before you came. The tourists are thinking, well, we came over here and it's a very exclusive resort and we're paying a lot of money and we expect it to be safe. But like all small towns, there's secrets, and in this book we realise quickly that there are women who've gone missing over the years in this place and nobody really talks about it, and maybe the latest victim is,
you know, because a woman who goes missing back in the 90s could well be living happily with a new partner and maybe half a dozen children in Helsinki. Well, in the case of Finns, not half a dozen children, but one or two children in Helsinki. And that deepens the mystery. Alex himself is an interesting character because he comes from a working class trade union background. His dad is a trade union leader and he has sold out, if you like, and he feels guilty about that.
Yeah, he's sold his soul for money. And I suppose he's rebelling against his father a little bit. He's from the north of England and that kind of working class family. And he comes down to London to work as a lobbyist. So he's, when we meet him, he's eating in one of those restaurants with the Ostravia caviar and the Screaming Eagle wine. And he's living this lifestyle, but never comfortable with it. And he's much more comfortable in Lapland and the kind of basic necessities that you need over there just to survive.
Yeah, that dawns on him eventually. But I mean, he finds out that his sister Vicky, her body turns up, and he goes out there to find out what happened and to bring her body home. And then, you know, the realization that she has been murdered. But she was the indulged younger sister.
She and I'm the eldest in my family, and I think we all carry that. The youngest is always more indulged, and she is particularly so in this novel. She is she's kind of floating from place to place. She's a tour guide, she's a rep, she's whatever will bring money in and she can have a good time. But they're also estranged, and when he realizes that she's dead, he's been ignoring her for some time and she's tried to call him, and he's carried that guilt, which is what drives him forward to try and find out what happened to her.
Okay, so the mysteries, as I say, they deepen because the link becomes apparent between perhaps other disappearances. But we'll leave that there, because people should, as I say, I'm enjoying the book enormously at the moment, about halfway through, and I don't want to give too much away for prospective readers. You mentioned that you chose the location because you already had a familiarity with it. How come?
I'm in pre-production on a show there at the moment. We'd pause it for COVID, but we're doing it's actually a show where some Irish characters go over, and it's a Fargo-esque kind of crime show. So it's one of those, not all the TV shows I'm working on bring me location scouting, but this one had me in Lapland a few times, and I was the guinea pig. They made me do everything that the Irish characters would do. So they submersed me in icy pools, and they brought me husky sledding, and they sent me ice fishing and everything, so I could ride it very authentically. So it's one of those perks of TV where you just get brought to, you get the key to the city in a nice way.
Now, tell me how you got your break in writing, because you might have been in politics. I mean, not just as a researcher, a political advisor in Leinster House, but as a representative.
Yeah, I mean, I've always wanted to be a writer. This is my dream. I love politics and I'm still quite political, and all of the books are kind of imbued with that sense of society and political issues. But writing is my dream, is what I wanted to do. And I was lucky. I was working in Leinster House with Piers Doherty. And I don't know if people realise, he's a huge crime fiction fan. And when I told him that I was writing my first book, instead of saying, you know, concentrate on the work you're doing, he was like, that's fantastic. Off you pop, you know. And I wrote it and I submitted it to the Richard and Judy Search for Bestseller at the time. And it was shortlisted out of thousands and thousands, the only Irish entrant. And I got a publishing deal straight away. And I just took a leap off a cliff and went into writing full time after that.
So now you have how many books to your name?
This is my 11th.
Your 11th book. Mm-hmm. And also how many TV series to your name and projects?
Four TV shows filmed and have shown, and I'm working on 11 projects at the moment.
My goodness. Now, yourself and your husband actually are almost like a conglomerate, a partnership now. What does he do in terms of the household, the literary and movie making household?
A conglomerate, that's fantastic. I'm going to rename our company now. It's like Succession in our house. he's home. We have four children and we work together at home, and he's my editor. He's my first editor and my first reader. And he is the benchmark for me, because he's not a crime fiction fan. He doesn't tend to read crime fiction books. So if I can catch him with a novel and with a plot, I think I've caught everybody, because it's not his natural genre.
So what does he read for pleasure? You know, if it's not your books, what would he read?
Highbrow, much more highbrow than me. He reads autobiographies and history books, but actually what he really does is watch football.
There's a familiar kind of expression there. Yeah, what does he do? He watches football. So says many, many people across the country. So he reads first, and if you can hook him in, then you know you can hook the general crime reader in.
I have everybody. And I gauge him for emotions as well, because I think one of the things with a crime book is, yes, you've got the plot and the pace and the characters, but you need to have emotion. You need to feel for a victim. And if I see him getting teary or upset, you know, he's not naturally that way. So I realise at that point I've done my job.
Now, how did you get the breakthrough into the small screen?
The drama commissioner, Jane Gogan in RTE, she had read some of my books and asked me, did I have an original show on me? And that was 4 years ago. And I created and co-wrote Taken Down with Stuart Carolyn. And that show hadn't even filmed, and I was asked to doctor a Danish show. And when you script doctor a show, you get all the money and none of the credits. So I'm never allowed to speak about it. But it just spiraled. I mean, I worked on Sanditon, the Jane Austen show for ITV and Masterpiece last year. And we've Harry Wilde coming to RTE this summer. I co-wrote that with David Logan. I've not stopped to take a breath. It just keeps going.
Now, and you have to ride the wave when the wave is there.
Yes.
Because you never know the day nor the hour when it'll all kind of dry up, although I suspect it never will in your case. The difference in screenwriting to writing fiction for the printed word, how would you characterize that difference?
It's night and day. I mean, the printed word is all you. It's a very natural form of personal storytelling. Screenwriting is collaborative and it's visual, and it's also dictated to by budget. So if I want to have helicopter or plane crashes on TV, I can't, because the money man will come in and say no. And you're also working with a team of producers and actors, and it is your story and it is you and you're driving it. But at the same time, it's realistically, it's a team effort. So if you can, very few people can do both. If you can move between them, I think it enhances both forms of writing.
Yeah. I mean, the kind of thing you need to do in a book, you might spend several pages. Like, for example, when you're describing Kuppi in Lapland and as part of Finland, you are describing the icy wastes and the lake and, you know, how you can drive a truck across a lake at certain times of the year, but at other times you'd fall through it if you walked on it. You spend time trying to evoke that waste.
It's my job to paint the picture in your mind, yeah, purely using words.
But like 10 seconds on telly will say all of that. You know, the fir trees covered in snow, the icy lake, 10 seconds and we're there.
And you would think it would mean you could write TV quicker, but you can't, because TV eats story. That's what we say. So a 60
eats
page
story.
Eats story. A 60 page script to keep a viewer hooked on a TV show for 60 minutes. There's more story goes into that than there does in a 400 page novel.
Now, how did you learn the screenwriting trade? I mean, is it because obviously writing a book in school, you write various bits of creative this and creative that, and you maybe develop the skill. I don't know whether you ever took a creative writing course in terms of dialogue. No. So that's one thing. But then to go into screenwriting, a different discipline.
Yeah, I mean, I learned on the job. I downloaded Final Draft. I was lucky. I was with a very experienced screenwriter on my first show, Stuart Carolyn, and I just pretty much learned how to do it as I was doing it. I think if you can tell a story, you can tell a story. You need to be taught how to structure an episode because it's a lot more pacey. But I'm still learning on the job. I'm hopefully getting better.
So at the moment, anyway, you've got so many TV projects on the go, and, you know, they certainly help to pay the bills.
TV pays the bills in a way that books, well, I think I'm very successful as an author now. When you start off in the author world, it's a hard hill to climb. TV is paved with gold.
Yeah. I've read a piece, an interview that you gave where you said that everything you do is informed where you came from and, you know, not being well off growing up, and you are determined that you never will be not well off ever again in your life.
Yeah, I sat at a lunch with journalists in London last week, and there were journalists from all the very well-established papers, The Guardian, Financial Times, all of these. And every single one of those journalists came from a working class background. And we joked because we said we're all defensively working class, but here we are sitting in a high-end restaurant in Soho. But we were talking about the commonality of when you come from a working class background, if you succeed, you tend to succeed harder and faster, and you work very hard to stay up there because you know what it's like to have nothing. So yeah, it's a common denominator.
Yeah, and that drives you.
Yeah.
And still drives you. Well, it's a terrific book. I'm enjoying everything about it, I have to say. There was something you said before about the Finns, though, and you've captured the personality very well. I mean, even in Formula One, the Finns in Formula One don't ever get terribly excited about anything. But what was the line that an introverted Finn will
look at their shoes when they're talking to you, and an extroverted Finn will look at your shoes when they're talking to you? And it's true.
Now, the book is called The Last to Disappear. It's published by Quercus. It's a really terrific read. It's available everywhere right now, just been released. And it's author Joe Spain. Thank you very much, Joe, for joining us on the programme today.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.